The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This world wants peace. The United States wants peace. Britain, France, the Soviet Union, the common market, Japan, all of us want peace. Everybody wants peace. China wants peace. Everybody you can mention wants peace. Bangladesh, Pakistan, India. And we want it so badly that we are willing to go to war to get it. The United States wants it so badly that it is willing to arm other little countries to the teeth so they can go out and get it. The Soviet Union wants peace so badly that it's willing to supply Arab nations and any other countries that will move a little closer toward the communist orbit. At least, if they don't do that, adopt some kind of a posture against the West, against the United States and the free world, and against capitalism, freedom, democracy, and supply them with plenty of arms so they can wage war to achieve their own brand of peace. Isn't it amazing that Bible prophecy that says back in the book of Jeremiah, they cry, peace, peace, when there is no peace? You can listen to everything from ladies' bridge clubs to civic organizations to the speeches delivered by keynoters at global conventions, or the recent one that I speak of would be, for instance, Henry Kissinger's remarks before the assembled delegates of practically all the nations of the earth in a Rome conference on food and famine. They talk about peace. They talk about the global problems confronting mankind. We all admit collectively that it's impossible, it's unthinkable now, to conceive of the idea of going to war to solve human problems, that we have to find some greater, more equitable method of settling disputes when people simply can't get along and can't agree together. But that prophecy in the book of Jeremiah is absolutely true. We give lip service to peace, we say we want it, but peace means different things to different people. To some people living practically side by side, it means almost the exact opposite. To the Israeli people in Israel, peace means the Arabs off their back. It means totally secure borders. It means going about their own business of living their own lives in productivity and in harmony within clearly defined national borders that are protected and secure and somehow guaranteed against attack, with no terrorist activities inside the country, bombing, blasting, maiming, killing Israeli men, women, and children. They merely want to be left alone. That to them is peace. The Arabs can have no peace if the Israelis have peace the way the Israelis look at it, because the Arabs simply don't want Israel to exist. I remember so well when I was first over there, clear back in 1966, before the 67 Jew-Arab War, when the Israelis grabbed so much of the territory that is still in dispute from day to day, not only in the United Nations, but of course among all the Arab countries, a thorn in their side, the grabbing of the Sinai, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and the whole bit that happened in the 67 war. And, of course, the eastern side of the city of Jerusalem, or the Old City, as a part of that prize that they grabbed. Well, those days you had to go first, of course, to the Arab country, and then, or whatever Arab countries, and then to Israel, because if you went to Israel first and they stamped your passport, you would never be allowed to get off the aircraft and to enter into one of the Arab countries. Their hatred was so extreme that even to see the Israeli stamp in your passport, they wouldn't let you enter their country. Many American citizens got around that by asking the Israeli customs officials and immigration officials if they would just stamp a loose piece of paper inside the passport. And they complied, because they knew Americans may want to travel to Cairo to see the museum, or down to Karnak or someplace, or to look at old King Tut's tomb, or to go see the pyramids. Although once you've been there, you can't imagine why. I mean, especially if you went inside. But at any rate, I was sitting in an Intercontinental Hotel one time, and I had gotten an almanac. I've told this story, but it was interesting. I picked it up in Beirut, and I wanted to look up some statistics. I wanted some production statistics, some land area, some geographical and ethnic and religious statistics about the number of people in the country and the size of cities, the number of people of this and that, religion and productivity and GNP and all that. So I picked up a World Almanac. And I was about to go across what was called the Mandelbaum Gate in those days, and you had to go to the no man's land, where you saw all sorts of shell-shattered buildings and barbed wire fences and machine gun emplacements, and on the one hand you would see the Israeli soldiers peeking out through their fortifications, looking over towards you as you were on the Jordanian side of the old city of Israel, divided by a place called Hell in the Bible, the Valley of Gehenna or Hinnom, where the sons of Hinnom used to own that property, and the word Gehenna in the Greek, from which the word Hell comes, at least in some few cases, mostly it's translated out of the word Hades, but that valley divided the old and the newer city, the Jewish side of Jerusalem, from the old city, the city of David. David's tomb, the Wailing Wall, all of that, the most holy places to the Jewish religion, were denied the Jews during those long years of deprivation of their own holy places. They couldn't get to them. They could kind of wail at the wall by climbing a hill or a parapet and looking over at it, or looking at where they thought it might be and wail at it, but they couldn't get to the wall to wail against the wall. So the Wailing Wall was deprived them in those days. It was kind of a hairy experience in one sense. You had to take a cab down to no man's land. They let you out. And, you know, when you're traveling through several different countries with about six people, you got a lot of baggage. And so you were dumped unceremoniously out of the cab, and you pick up your baggage, and you promptly walk. You'd make, you know, quite a few hundred yards there. Walk, carrying your bags over to the other side, all the time hoping the war doesn't start while you're out there in the middle of it all, defenseless, with Jordanian soldiers with their machine guns and rifles pointing over your heads at the Israelis and vice versa. But you know, as I sat there in that coffee lounge and wanted to look up some statistics about Israel, I paged through the nations and got to the eyes. And I went up and back a little bit and I thought, well, where in the world is it? And I tried to separate the pages and I found a couple of the pages were inextricably stuck together. And I kept trying to work them apart, and they would not come apart. And finally, just the little edges did, where I could see a little corner. That was the page I wanted, all right. The description of Israel was there. But you know, some character in that Beirut bookshop had glued the pages of the almanac that I bought together so nobody could even look up the word Israel. Now, I was sitting in that coffee shop there in the Intercontinental Hotel. They had a little card, you know, the way restaurants will, to advertise some of their fare, maybe their wine list or their dessert or something, and it said, you know, welcome to the Holy Land and this and that for American tourists, and it had the old proverbial map you used to remember making salt and flour maps out of when you were a kid in grade school, of the Holy Land, Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea, the Maritime Plain, and all of the highlights of the country. And here were the political borders clearly identified: Iran, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt. And right in between them all, along the coastline from north of Haifa, down there towards the Gaza Strip. This was in 1966 now. Before the 67 war, there was this blank spot. It wasn't even labeled. There was no name on it. Now, wasn't that interesting? I mean, the people that make those little cards showing the geographical entities, an interesting little map that happened to be on a restaurant table, deliberately even left out the state of Israel. These people's mentality was such that they could not admit to themselves that there was a bona fide nation there. It's interesting now, then, to see how some of the Arab countries are reacting at the incredible kind of blackmail that resulted in the admission of a man who is a known killer and gangster and murderer, such as Yasser Arafat, as they call him in New York with that unbelievable accent. But anyway, Yasser Arafat. I guess he got that name from saying Yasser, Yasser, Yasser to his dad. I don't know. Anyway, Yasser Arafat comes in there, lifts his arms high in a victory salute, pudgy, fat little guy, and makes this speech to a standing ovation. Now, of course, the Arabs that really are 100% for that believe that there is a natural claim, and the UN is beginning to recognize that claim. Now, you're going to watch and see the spectacle of all of these Arab states saying that the United Nations, when it acts, when it says yes, when it says the Palestinians have a right to that land, you're going to hear an awful lot made over that. But when you go back to 1947, in those years just after World War II and 1948, when there was another great UN decree. During the time when a man named David Ben-Gurion was over there in Israel. And that decree said that the Israeli people had a right to certain territorial claims and had a right to exist as a bona fide recognized state in that area. Well, of course, you know, the war that immediately broke out, the Israelis had to enforce that. They had then to go to war to grab what the UN said was rightfully theirs, and a horrible bloodletting ensued, which actually resulted in that intolerable situation of insecure borders, of a little really kind of like a corridor leading to Jerusalem, one little enclave there with Jordanians on every side. And the caravan, and even to this day, you know, if you've been to Israel and you've driven from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, you will see the old kind of reddish trucks. Well, they painted them with anti-rust or rust-preventative paint year after year to keep them as a kind of a monument of that relief caravan that tried to fight its way up that narrow defile, thickly forested on both sides, where an Arab trap was there, and they rained a hail of fire and mortar fire and grenades down on them and killed I don't know how many, but there are literally probably more than a dozen trucks clearly discernible today. And of course, they hauled off a lot more. When they built the new road, they even dragged some down off the mountain and the narrow little road that has now been bypassed and put them in plain sight. So there's kind of like a continual reminder, like a national monument there, of that food relief caravan that was trying to fight its way to Jerusalem in that war clear back in 1948. Well, it's interesting that is, you know, what's good for one is not necessarily what's good for another. Now the Palestinians are terribly deliriously happy over the fact that the PLO is supposed to be the one representative. Well, apparently they don't all agree with that. There are 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 at last count, and probably several more developed since I've read the last article on how many Arab-Palestinian guerrilla organizations there are. There's the Black September group. There are those factions within the PLO which would like to bring the PLO down. I frankly think Arafat's life is hanging by a slim thread. I don't think those characters, those gangsters and murderers, can trust each other out of each other's sight. I wouldn't turn my back if I were Arafat, because there are so many little splinter organizations within the PLO who, because of their, you know, unbelievable egotistical vanity, all of whom would like to be like a little Hitler, the head of any new government. Can you imagine the lust, the greed, the vanity, the toadish egotism that even now beats within the breast of many a little creepy criminal that hides out and tries to blast women and children under the pretense of some political cause, who would love to get at the helm of some emerging new government and emerge as a great new leader in that area? I'll tell you, I kind of pity King Hussein, because he has lived in and through so many different assassination attempts, the one most famous perhaps when his own grandfather was killed at the Al-Aqsa Mosque so many years ago when he was a very young man. And I've read his autobiography called Uneasy Lies the Head, I think a very good title of King Hussein's. My father has met King Hussein and talked with him, and we have interviewed him and had his picture in our Plain Truth publication. King Hussein is not really the favorite of the Palestinians, because they have virtually waged war against Hussein and his regime in Jordan, and his own army has had to put them down because they would have tried to take over his government. Now, failing that, they're trying to set up one of their own on the West Bank. But, you know, it isn't really which government or which land. I'm not quite clear on that. I don't really think that matters to some of these would-be little dictators. I think any government, any country, any land would do. They can just find a place to roost and be the king of the mountain. So I think Arafat had better look out, because there are probably 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 of his own lieutenants and henchmen who would dearly love to kill the little man and take over for him. But it's interesting. When you look at the way people pursue peace in this world, the Arabs say they want peace. Now, I've been to Israel and I've been to Arab countries, and I have seen with my own eyes many thousands of Arabs living at peace inside Israel. I've seen the way they live. Nablus is almost an entirely Arab town. Matter of fact, it was in the marketplace at Nablus recently where an Israeli was assassinated, simply from walking along looking at some of the wares that were for sale. But there are many thousands, and people tend to pass over that rather easily, of Arabs who stayed. And those who fled didn't really have to. An awful lot of them could have stayed, and a lot more could have been invited right back if they wanted to live at peace inside Israel. The shame in all of this to me is here on the one hand you have the little nation of Israel with perhaps one of the highest per capita ratios of doctors, lawyers, of artists, of engineers, of dentists, of people that are literists, that are archaeologists, historians, educators, because of the influx of a professional class of people from so many of the Western countries. On the other hand, many more agrarian-oriented and nomadic-type peoples who came from Yemen or Morocco, the Yemenitish Jews and the Moroccan Jews who have migrated in there, a few at least, who have come from Russia of recent date, so you have a homogeneous crowd of people with many different dialects who are given a crash 6 weeks program in Hebrew, the national language, to try to put everything together there. But the expertise that exists, if there could be cultural and educational exchanges, and even trade and development between the Arab countries and Israel, the entirety of the Middle East would benefit. Now here are the Arabs sitting atop billions upon billions of petrodollars, and of course, beginning to invest a lot of those inside the United States, and there could be something afoot there that you ought to be aware of, which is another subject. But it's been said that the Arabs are getting so many petrodollars they don't even know where to invest them all. Now, you see, recently they decided they won't even take any more British pounds. They want gold or some other kind of currency. They want dollars. They want something beside the British pound because they know it can't be trusted. They're not even sure it's worth what it says on the bill there. That came out just very recently. So here you have the situation where it is admitted very plainly that many of these Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, so many of them, can't invest the money in their own countries because a country can just take so much investment. There isn't any way to build to develop faster. But there would be if they would seek some of the expertise that is available in Israel, if they would seek some of the farming methods, the irrigation, the agriculture that has made Israel blossom like a rose in the desert. If they would seek some of the technical know-how that is available in the brain trust that is in that country, and share in the development and the growth in the Middle East. The Arabs could provide the money, the Israelis could provide the know-how, and they could get together and really develop something over there. But no, the old racism, the hatreds have got to be there, and it's on both sides. I mean, I'm not just justifying one side or the other. People will think I'm talking totally against the Arabs. No, I'm not against the Arabs, I'm for them. I want them to have peace and happiness and success and joy and love and fulfillment and reward. I don't want them to get themselves killed in wars. Neither do I want them to precipitate a war which could bring about World War III. And the same thing goes for the Israelis. But as you look at the microcosm of all of humanity in the Middle East, the boiling, steeping, seething, hate-filled Middle East that totters, it seems, on the brink of a war about every 6 weeks, you see all of the world in correct perspective. We say we want peace, and we're willing to go to war to prove it. We say we want peace, we want to limit arms, and so we make a deal which allows the United States to build bigger booster rockets and to catch up with the Soviets to equalize the arms race in that direction, which gives the Soviets time, who had not yet developed the entire MIRV system, to develop a MIRV system and to grow toward the same capability of the United States in strategic deployment of multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles, multiple warheads, nuclear warheads, in the big Soviet boosters. So instead of it being an arms limitation, it merely spells out the ground rules, which will be difficult, if not impossible, to police for the growth and the development of a bigger arms race. The international arms race is alive and well in the name of national defense forces all around the world. Japan, Europe, Africa, anywhere you want to look. India has exploded a device it refuses to call a bomb. I say if the dumb thing blows up, it's a bomb. So India has the bomb. Whatever you want to call something that blows up, you want to call it an explosive device, that's fine. But that's just playing around with words. It's a bomb. Now, whether we like to realize this or not, the United States of America is supplying arms both overtly through government sources and covertly through private sources. Old World War II rifles, machine guns, and all that type of thing go out of the United States and from even European armories and places of storage to countries all over the world. There's a man named Cummins. There's quite a book about that. In the entire international arms traffic of how millions of rifles and machine guns and pistols and grenades and mortars and so on have been sold. And these arms caches that were built by so many governments that resulted in, you know, the storage of millions of pieces of weapons in the armories and the storage warehouses on military bases all over the United States and all over the world, well, these have been purchased sometimes for only a few cents on the dollar from some of these private arms dealers who have become millionaires in arms traffic. Many a country has been armed with old British 303 Enfields and old American M1 carbines, as well as the M1 rifle, and BARs and World War II weapons of some of the countries that ended up with millions of pieces of arms in storage. So the arms race goes on. Nation after nation is very easily able to salve its conscience of seeing its people starve to death, seeing virtually no paved roads, no hospitals, no schools, no goods or services, no real viable economy whatsoever, an agrarian or maybe a nomadic society, but its military despotic leadership wants supersonic jets, it wants tanks, it wants guns, it wants weapons, and it wants an army. Because, you see, the very first order of business of each new emerging little despot, each would-be Hitler, whether it's in Africa, the periphery of Southeast Asia, where war goes on unabated every single day in Vietnam, whether the United States directly is involved or not, the war still goes on over there. The first order of business is to consolidate that little Hitler's power. And to do that, you've got to have an army that is solidly behind you. Now, in South America, the army is behind you, and that's the worst place for the army to be. Because an army behind the leader in South America usually means the guns are pointed at the leader, and the leaders come and go and topple like tenpins. And so usually you always find that somewhere in the army will be some enterprising young colonel who will want to be the next dictator. And it's a tiresome business. But you know, we like to feel that the United States doesn't arm a lot of these countries, and that the United States of America is not the biggest arms supplier and trafficker on the face of the earth. We like to feel that, but it's not true, because the United States is the largest dealer in military hardware and weaponry, both from the government and from private sources on the face of the earth. But the way we rationalize around that is that if we didn't give them the weapons, somebody else would. And we like to reason, especially in the case of Jordan, for example, where we supply King Hussein with U.S.-made tanks, and we supply the Israelis with U.S.-made tanks. So the Arabs can get in U.S.-made tanks and shoot at the Israelis, and the Israelis can get in U.S.-made tanks and shoot back at the Arabs. We supply the Arabs with United States-made aircraft, and we supply the Israelis with U.S.-built aircraft. But we like to argue that if we didn't, somebody else would. And where military hardware goes, probably experts, so-called, such as recent years in Egypt, until finally we hope most of them were kicked out, will follow. Which means that the Soviet Union, the chief arms supplier for the Arab countries in the Middle East, would also send some of its political influence and its military experts, which would get control of the government and which would certainly influence government. We even found during the last go-around in the Middle East that there were literally Russian pilots at the controls of MiG jets, and there were Russians that were operating some of the SAM sites. Russian officers inside the Egyptian army. So the arms race is alive and well. And we like to think that because we can retain some kind of influence over some of these clients that buy our arms, that we should go ahead and sell them the weapons. And of course, it helps us to pay for our own defense spending. If we can sell some of these costly things of many, many millions of dollars per copy, the last I heard it was something like $14 to $17 million for each F-15 or F-14 fighter plane. Now that's an incredible amount of money. Of course, right now, Los Angeles is screaming to the heavens about the infamous check business of nearly $1 million that was gotten away with by somebody and apparently laundered through a couple of bank transactions and ended up in Switzerland. Nobody knows where the money is. But you know, when you stop to think, that amount of money would just about buy a Super King Air 100. And when you start to think about the kind of money we're talking about that is flowing out of the United States in this oil blackmail business of the quadrupling of oil prices and what is flowing into the coffers of the Arab countries, there's the biggest grand theft in the history of all the world. Now, we can argue, well, they need that money, and then you can answer, what for? They've got so much of it now, they don't know where to develop it. I mean, where to invest it? They could come over here and buy practically every major industry in the United States and still have a lot left over. And, of course, a lot of people suspect that may be happening. But in the meantime, we like to think we're headed for peace, that a world war is not in the immediate offing. Here is Europe in chaos with deepening unemployment, with skyrocketing inflation, with one government after another finding itself in a terrible situation as its balance of payments deficits continue to mount up because its cost of importing oil in particular is so much higher than any money it can make from its exports that it simply goes into debt year after year. In Britain, it was a staggering $1 billion a month. The same thing for Italy. $1 billion difference a month. $1 billion indebtedness a month. $1 billion difference in what it had to pay for what it was importing to keep the thing fueled and going as to what it was making from its exports, inside or outside of the common market. We like to think that war is not just around the corner, but it is. You are living in what is called in the Bible the time of the end. The Bible talks about an end time where a mysterious king of the south would push at, make some overt gesture toward, it doesn't say exactly what, in the 11th chapter of Daniel, verse 40, would push at a king of the north, one consolidated grouping of nations in the south, the south of Palestine, the south of the area from which the Bible views the world ethnically, historically, politically, geographically, and prophetically. And that would be the area of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the oil-rich Arab countries of the Persian Gulf. And it would push at some powerful northern country who would react with fury and come like a whirlwind with ships and planes and tanks and guns. And it's described in Old King James English language, but has to be understood in modern military terminology. And it says they would even enter into the Holy Land. And the language that is used in that 11th chapter of Daniel, beginning in about verse 40, does not say they would conquer or destroy. It said they would enter into the Holy Land, possibly even at the direct invitation of the Israeli government. Because, believe it or not, by the time there are nuclear weapons scattered around the Middle East, I am sure the Israelis would turn practically anywhere. And, of course, the one country that could stand to gain the most eventually out of the healing of old wounds, to go to the Israelis' defense, at least overtly it would appear to be that, would be the nation of Germany, West Germany. Now that's speculation, that maybe a coming United States of Europe would someday send a multilateral peacekeeping force on its own, outside the auspices of either the UN or NATO, to the Middle East. Not only to protect Israel, but just maybe to take militarily what it must have to survive, oil, and which it can no longer afford to pay for. Well, that's the world in which we live. We say we want peace, but we don't really know that peace is just ahead. You need to write for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine and get these up-to-the-moment articles, the one on love and marriage, new defense for Europe, the one on our present crime wave, and the one on global famine. All you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales.